Thank you, everyone, for joining us. So the title of this panel, I think, is Making the Grade, Assessing Central Banks. I want to start off with Kevin, right to my left. Grade the Fed. How have they done in the last year? And what would you do differently if you were running the place?
Well, thanks for starting us off with a softball like that, John. So John used to cover us back in my days at the Fed a long time ago. In terms of letter grades, sort of in modern elite institutions, certainly of academic learning, we don't give letter grades anymore because we don't want to offend the sensibilities of our students. We want them to feel like they're all getting A's.
Pass, fail? Are you going to give them a pass?
So I guess I'd say need substantial improvement.
Okay.
I think that's as far as I'd go on a grade. It's a beautiful day in Washington. I don't want to start out too critical. In terms of what to do differently, I think in light of the biggest economic policy error in the last 45 years by the central bank, which led to this massive surge of inflation, in light of the errors that have made in the last 6 months, promising in December that mission accomplished, we'd hit our inflation objective, now having to lurch back to the other side in recent days, I think my best advice is deep introspection. What are the structural errors we're making in thinking and conducting policy? What is our theory of inflation? In some sense, the Fed's theory of inflation reminds me of the dominant theories of inflation in the 1970s. And it goes something like this. America's inflation problem is because workers are earning too much and living too well. Well, I don't believe any of that. America's inflation problem is because the government's living too well, spending too much, printing too much, monetizing too much. And I think at the core errors in the conduct of policy is inability to think anew about what is inflation, how do we measure it, and lastly, who's responsible for it. And I'll just end with a final word, John, which is inflation's a choice. It's a choice largely by the fiscal and monetary authorities. Inflation isn't subject to war and pestilence. The Fed isn't a victim. This isn't anguish. The Fed is responsible for the inflation rate, and the Fed needs to take ownership of it.
So I want to come back to some of this, but first I want to move on to Adam. Inflation is the question of the day. The Fed, as you said, suggested that it had felt they felt they had the job done by the end of last year. We've gotten 3 months of not so great data. Adam, what is your outlook for inflation in 2024? Is it coming down, and is the Fed going to cut rates this year, or are they going to end up in a position where they either have to stay on hold or raise them?
Well, thank you, John. Thanks to 7-4 for having me. I want to generally associate myself with the thrust of Kevin that the Fed has been communicating in a very data-dependent and therefore extremely inconsistent way, and it comes out of some mistakes and lack of knowledge or lack of rethinking. And that doesn't mean that the rethinking is easy or obvious. But so when we get to the inflation outlook, I'll try to be disciplined and respond to your questions, John. When we get to the inflation outlook, I think I've been saying for a while now that the Fed was going to cut fewer times later than what markets priced in. I think the upside risks of a hike in 2015 are much higher, not so much because inflation is going to go way up now, but I think the odds, either way, whoever wins the election, of some additional fiscal excess and uncertainty and the ongoing legacy of the industrial policy, which are these open-ended commitments that could add up to hundreds of billions of dollars, mean we're going to have inflation in 2015. And so I think it's less about this year. They probably will hold off, and that's probably
right. You're saying 2015, you mean
2025? I'm terribly sorry. I'm old.
Yeah.
2025 to all you young people. Thank you for correcting me.
So are we going to get to 2% this year, or are we stuck in this?
I think headline will fluctuate around 2% and a little higher. I think there is all this, if you want to get into the arcana, as I know our colleagues do, about rent and how rent gets translated and energy prices coming out of the Middle East and so on. I mean, this is the one place I slightly disagree with Kevin, is that sometimes you do get inflation for reasons that have nothing to do with the Fed. The question is, how fast do you bring it back down? And so we could get inflation because of the Middle East, because of energy, because of something else. But basically, inflation's going to be running, I think, core inflation's going to be running basically flat where it is now.
So, Karen, I want to talk about fiscal policy. There's been a lot of talk today, including on this panel now, about large budget deficits, large levels of federal debt. In the 1990s, we had these creatures on Wall Street called bond market vigilantes that sent a signal to Washington, you have to get deficits under control. It led to elevated long-term interest rates. The bond market vigilantes appear to be dead. Where are they? How do you think about budget deficits and debt and the sustainability and how you price a bond as a result of that?
So the first thing I'd give perspective on is it's been a very, very, very long time in any market trader's memory since supply and demand really set the price of bonds, meaning that the people who had to buy all the issuance done to fund the fiscal deficit were people who cared about price, looked at the bond yield level and asked themselves, is this a good bond yield? And I would go back before quantitative easing. I would go back before the financial crisis to when what you had going on was, you know, the rise in emerging markets and the desire to keep their currencies low and the need to basically accumulate dollars in order to keep their currencies low. That was a tremendous flow that went into the United States bond market regardless of what the yield was. And so you sat here in the early 2000s and basically said, wait a minute, a lot of people are willing to buy US debt not caring what the yield is because of other reasons. These are not people who are driven by profit and loss. And we know what the effect of that was, right? Which is that yields were lower than they need to be, interest rates were lower than they need to be, that forced someone to borrow. So not only did the government borrow as much as they wanted, but other people did, mostly households, and then we got a housing crisis. Then you go into the financial crisis and you get the era of quantitative easing. That is a massive, massive, massive buyer that doesn't care about price, right? The Fed is not in there saying, I'm gonna decide what the right bond yield is. And so now it's gonna be the first time in 2025 or so where you'll actually need whatever the government's gonna borrow, you'll need to actually find private capital willing to say, I like that interest rate and I choose it over other things.
So are you saying that the bond market vigilante is going to make a comeback? And that we're entering a period where there's a premium again, a term premium again for owning long-term debt?
Well, first I'd say bond vigilantes did come back in the UK, right? Like they went through a very clear bond vigilante episode, which said, hey, that's ridiculous. You can't do that fiscally. That's not going to work. Now, of course, exacerbated by different liquidity dynamics and whatnot, but I would say that was a bond vigilante episode they just went through. Whether the US goes through it really depends on basically what the exceptional status will remain for both short-term US debt, which people consider literally equivalent to cash. So the one thing that the US Treasury did, which no other Treasury has done to anything like this degree, is say, wait a minute, I need to issue a lot. You know what I should do? I'm just gonna do it all in T-bills. I mean, can you imagine if like the Brazilians were like, you know what, we're just gonna fund it all on 3-month paper? That would clearly not work. But for the US, it could. That's a very unique economy that people think of T-bills as literally the same as cash. And then on the other side, what will happen abroad, what will happen to other buyers that might be uneconomic, how much they're going to want treasuries. But the probability, I would say, that bond vigilantes will be relevant again in the next 2 years is pretty meaningful because we're just going to have a lot less uneconomic buyers and a fiscal level that's a lot higher deficit than we had before for kind of structural reasons, leading to you really do need to compete for that capital. And the private market can send a signal that there's too much borrowing being done by the government for the first time in a long time.
Can I just piggyback one point? I think she's absolutely right. And the UK is a warning to many people, if not the US. But additionally, because of the tensions with China from the US, from others, we're starting to see barriers go up on flow of investment back and forth between China and US. And so going back to the early 2000s, I think I got the date right. If we're reducing the ability of savings glut from East Asia and China in particular to come to the US and buy treasuries or making it less attractive, that's another force up on bonds in the same spirit that you're having a smaller pool of private borrowers who are price sensitive.
Kevin, what do you think? You think that if you were a policymaker in Washington right now, would you be concerned that there's a bond market blowout coming down the road?
So I'm a risk-averse, has-been central banker. Everything worries me. I associate myself with my two colleagues up here. The U.S. government is about 40% bigger than the day before COVID. According to the president's budget, the size of the government, the expenditures of the government will be larger than it's ever been in the history of the world for the next 10 years. And my recollection of history is we can set tax rates wherever we want. The American people will only give us something like 19% of GDP. And if our government's spending on a federal basis 25%, that is begging the bond vigilantes to wake up from their slumber. I think good policymakers shouldn't be asking for the fight. They should be establishing some sort of fiscal anchor, some description that we are going to, especially at a time where the economy is at full employment, act within our means. Instead, what are we doing? We're begging the world for money at a time we shouldn't need it for a size of government we've never had, many of which for expenditures are not at all obvious that we need. So I think it's a problem. And I think Karen's point is the right one worth emphasizing. For most of the last 15 years, really since the 08 financial crisis at least, the four largest buyers of US government securities were price insensitive. Federal Reserve, the Chinese, the Japanese, and the big banks. Well, on the margin, they're all exiting that market. The Fed wants to get back into a balance sheet that's growing again, but inflation's making it harder. Buyers 5 through 50 will demand a different price. I think if you look lastly at the example from last fall, 10-year Treasury yields, this is the most important asset, the most important price anywhere in the world, and 10-year Treasuries went from about 3.8% to a bit more than 5%. And our government said, that's too expensive. And so what the Treasury did, and I understand why they did it, is they said on the margin, we're going to issue more T-bills. This is Karen's point. 10-year Treasury yields went from 5 to 4 very quickly. Well, they're creeping back up. I think that's the market's way of saying that the market clearing price, if you don't have these artificial buyers, is closer to 5. And that is huge fiscal implications. I'll just end with one statistic. For every percentage point that interest rates are ahead of the Congressional Budget Office estimate of what our government's funding costs should be, their average is around 4. For every 1 percentage point increase above that, then the increase in government interest expense in the next 10 years is $2.5 trillion. This crowds out things like that we need, a stronger military, a strong safety net, and this is creating a new $34 trillion entitlement that someone needs to defease. Imagine that we're not at a time of full employment. Imagine a time things are worse. Imagine a time that these wars just aren't some faraway place. We need to have the fiscal capability and credibility to tackle it.
So, Kevin, I have to ask you, your name is sometimes floated as a potential Fed chair in a Republican administration. Do you have a desire to get back into the game of policymaking?
So you'd think with John having covered me for years, he would avoid these sorts of questions. The Chairman Powell's term ends in May of 2026, as far as I can tell. That's a year and a half into the new administration.
Let me cut off your non-answer.
Yeah. I'm preparing another non-answer, but go for it.
Okay, all right. The question is, putting aside with Chair Powell's term, do you have an interest in being back in a policy game, or do you like it in the cushy environment of not giving students grades that might hurt their feelings?
So if you believe what, I'll put words in Adam's mouth, and he should feel free to disabuse them of, if you care as much about the country as we do, and you feel as though you've been so blessed to have incredible opportunities in the country, if your government calls, you have an open-mindedness to serve. If you believe what I believe, and a lot of people in Washington don't, so correct me on this, this is a hinge point in history. You might not know it when it feels like we're at full employment. This is as consequential a moment for the United States and the world as we've had in my adult lifetime. In some sense, more consequential than the darkest days of the 08 crisis when I was serving, where we in some sense didn't know exactly what to do, but we knew directionally what to do, and the whole world was there to help us and support us. People that we consider adversaries of the U.S. flew to Washington in the dark days of the 08 crisis and said, what can we do to help? if the world ends up in a darker place economically, geopolitically, do our allies trust us and come to our aid immediately? Are our adversaries fearful of us and respect our fiscal and monetary capability, never mind our credibility on war? I don't know. So I think it's a hugely consequential moment. If we get the next few years right, 21st century can be America's and the world can be better. If we get it wrong, I think it's pretty dark. So that's not a non-answer. That's a, the country needs, I think, new thinking across fiscal and monetary policy.
As a student of Kevin Warsh and central bank speak, I'm going to take that as an emphatic yes. So, I mean, there's a lot of conversation here about the mistakes that the Fed has made letting inflation get out of control, the problem of U.S. debt, rising U.S. debt levels. And yet, when you look at the value of the dollar, and going back to the days when I was covering the Fed with you, I heard people say over and over again that the Fed is going to destroy the value of the dollar. It's up 11% over the last 3 years. So, Karen, I want to ask you, how do you explain that, and how do you trade it?
So, not to be overdramatic, but I think the U.S. has a version of what economists thought of as Dutch disease with financial assets, meaning classic Dutch disease is like, I go fill my car up with gas. I'm not thinking I want to give money to Saudi Arabia. I'm just, whatever gas is there, I get. Right now, if you look at all the cross-border savings around the world, so every dollar in the world where somebody is saving in a country other than their own, 80% of that is ending up in the United States. And it's not because everybody just loves the US so much. You just look at the indices and you say, well, if you want to invest in stocks, what stocks exist in the world? It's mostly US stocks. If you want to invest in bonds, well, guess what? Japanese bonds are all owned by the Bank of Japan. You just don't have that many options of financial assets to invest in. And what the dollar move is telling you is that there's still more desire to buy all these financial US assets than there is on the US side to be, you know, spending and buying foreign exports and so on. And some of that comes from really believing in the US. The reality is the US has outperformed in really every possible way financially. So there's a reason why its assets, especially the stocks, have grown in market cap. But some of it is just normal, you invest according to what assets exist. And what that means is that the dollar is being supported by this kind of flow that thinks about, you know, just wanting to invest cross-border and ends up in America. That used to be very bond-oriented because it was very much these central banks looking to build up reserves. Today, a lot of that money is stocks. And so it's shifted much more to private sector players that are actually trying to make money off their investments. But the vast majority of what will drive whether their investments make money or not is the success of the stocks, not what the dollar does. The dollar is kind of an addendum in terms of how it performs. And so that's a lot of money that's showing up here and supporting the dollar and, you know, supporting it regardless. And, you know, I think it's interesting if you think about a world where, you know, Trump comes back in, you end up having more extreme tariffs. In some ways, that just becomes more dollar bullish because you make the trade deficit smaller, but you don't reduce any of these people's desire to be buying all these financial assets.
All right, so we have zeros across the clock. I want to ask everyone to give me a one sentence answer. What's the biggest risk on your mind looking out over the next year for the global economy, the markets, or whatever it is that's bothering you? Start with Kevin.
War.
One sentence.
War.
With war among between who?
Old-fashioned war.
Okay. All right. We'll leave it at that. Adam.
Further decoupling China and the U.S. feeding into war.
Karen.
Oof. It's hard to top those two. Let me add a milder form of this, but different accelerating Chinese economic warfare with the Chinese if we don't get hot war.
Okay, on that happy note, thank you.
Well done.